To our third study now, we look at the political problems that Hosea discusses. What I should really do here, I guess, is go back to the book of Kings and give you all the details of what was happening. Now, we simply don't have time for that, so I'll just fill you in with some tough tales for tiny tots. If you read the book of Kings, you'll find there's some very gory stories there. People seem to play musical chairs around the throne of Israel fairly effectively. People pushing each other off, stabbing in the back, dynasties lasting 1 week. Rather small time for a dynasty, as you all agree, I'm sure. This sort of chaos in Israel. What happened was this, and it's concerning Israel that Hosea is mainly concerned here in his discussion of these political problems. Jeroboam, that we read about in chapter 1, verse 1, Jeroboam reigned for a very long time, 40-odd years. And while he was reigning in Israel, in the corresponding kingdom to the south, Uzziah was reigning, and he reigned for 52 years. Now that means a very, very long time in both kingdoms, and much stability. Now you know that what happens after a person has reigned for a long time, you tend to get rapid changes in the government, because one person has sat in the throne for so long, and then there's a little bit of infighting goes on, and it's quite common for this long period of government to be followed by a period of rapid instability. Now that's exactly what happened in the case of Israel. Jeroboam II, he reigned for these 40-odd years. He was succeeded by his son Zechariah, and Zechariah lasted only 6 months before he was assassinated by a man called Shallum. And Shallum only lasted 1 week before he in turn was assassinated by a man called Menahem. Menahem was a bloodthirsty character, if ever there was one. He managed to survive for about 10 years, mainly because he bought protection from Assyria. Now this is where the problem sneaks in. By this time Assyria had become the dominant nation in the region, and Menahem sent tribute money to Assyria to bolster up his own throne. Menahem survived through the foreign aid that had come in, but of course it virtually ruined his country, because the Assyrians imposed their will upon Israel to such an extent that Israel went very close to losing its independence entirely. Menahem, as I say, lasted about 10 years, and then he was succeeded upon his death by his son called Pekahiah. But Pekahiah lasted only a month or so when he was assassinated by a man called Pekah. And when Pekah became king, he changed the whole of the religious policy. It was like an anti-communist regime being followed by a pro-communist regime, or vice versa, if you like, from extreme left to extreme right. Because just as Menahem had been pro-Assyria, Pekah was anti-Assyria. And now he started sending money to other countries, Egypt and others round about, to get them to come and fight against Assyria. Well, he survived a few years until he too was assassinated and succeeded by a man called Hoshea, no relation to this man Hosea. Hoshea then became pro-Assyrian again, and he survived through lots of trickery and skullduggery that he worked deals with other countries. Eventually he decided to turn anti-Assyria. You're still with me, I hope. And he then refused to pay any further tribute money, whereupon the Assyrians came in and kaput. That was the end of Samaria. It was besieged for a few years and then finally fell in 722 BC, and that was the end of the northern kingdom. The people were taken captive to Assyria, and that is the destruction that Hosea the prophet has spoken of so much. Now, all this political wheeling-dealing that was going on was creating absolute chaos in Israel. And we find now that all the plots, the counterplots, the assassinations, the murders, all the intrigue, this is the sort of thing that Hosea now talks about as he discusses some of the political problems. None of those problems would have existed had the people trusted in Jehovah. But they didn't trust in Jehovah. They trusted in military alliances. They trusted in Egypt at one time, and then they're trusting in Syria, then trusting in Assyria, and then back to Egypt, then somewhere else, and they're moving all over the place. Rapid changes of foreign policy, and the whole thing is just eating away at the foundation of the nation, and eventually it all crumbled. All right, we'll now turn to chapter 5, and we'll look at the first of the four sections that I've prepared on the political problems of the time. Not only was the southern nation guilty, I beg your pardon, the northern nation Israel, but the southern nation of Judah was equally guilty. And you find it referred to in verse 13 of chapter 5. When Ephraim, that is the northern kingdom, saw his sickness, and Judah, the southern kingdom, saw his wound, Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to the great king. Now, that's the sort of thing I'm referring to here when they're asking for foreign assistance. But, says the prophet, he is not able to cure you or heal your wound. For I, says Jehovah, will be like a lion to Ephraim, and like a young lion to the house of Judah. I, even I, will rend and go away. I will carry off, and none shall rescue. Summarizing that, we might say this. If you turn to foreign nations for help, eventually you'll fall under the domination of those foreign nations. The very ones that you have turned to for help will be the ones that God uses to punish you. And so it was that the people decided to walk by sight rather than by faith. The way of faith is the way of walking for God's people, but they didn't want the way of faith. They wanted power and chariots and horses and military strength. And the very things they trusted in were the very things that eventually destroyed them. And if we opt for those sorts of things, no matter what they be, instead of the way of faith and trust in Jehovah, eventually those things too will be the cause of the destruction of our Christian testimony. We are saved by faith, we live by faith, we walk by faith. And that's the way it should be with God's people in every era. The second portion I want to look at is the main portion in chapter 7, and full of rather difficult verses. Chapter 7. And here we have in verse 3 a reference to all these assassinations. By their wickedness they make the king glad, and the princes by their treachery. They make the princes glad by their treachery. That is, the successful assassin is pleased with his fellow plotters. They've plotted to overthrow the previous ruler. The rebel has succeeded in assassinating the former king, and now he himself becomes king. Everyone's very happy because they've all cooperated together and all the people have plotted and they've succeeded in their coup or their rebellion. But of course, the king who has now come to the throne is himself not safe. Because one thing you can always be sure of, that if you use skullduggery to pull the rug from under somebody else, sure as heck somebody's going to use that skullduggery to pull the rug from under you. And this was the lesson they learnt the hard way. And so by their wickedness they make their king glad, they make the princes glad by their treachery, but verse 4, they're all adulterers, they can't be trusted. They'll be going off to someone else in a minute, and then doing the same to you. They are like a heated oven, this is a weird one, they are like a heated oven whose baker ceases to stir the fire from the kneading of the dough until it is leavened. Now what's all that mean? I think it means something like this. They've got the picture of a baker cooking some bread. So you get the lump of dough and you put it in the oven. Now he has kneaded the dough and he's got it ready and he puts it in the oven, but he keeps the fire low, just warming it away there, until he's ready to give it a full blast. You see, they are like a heated oven. The baker doesn't stir the fire from the kneading of the dough until it is leavened. He doesn't stir it until he's ready to give it the heat he wants then to really cook it properly. Now that's what these plotters are like. You see, they just keep it nice and cool, boys, until they're ready to sink the dagger in. Plotting very carefully, very smoothly, very cunningly, until the time is ripe. And when the time is ripe, and that's one less to bother about. Verse 5. On the day of our king, the princes became sick with the heat of wine. He stretched out his hand with mockers. Now here again is a picture of all this king's buddies, or he assumes they're his buddies, having a big feast together. But what they're doing is getting him drunk. The king, unknowingly, is stretching out his hands with mockers. They're all reaching for this, that and the other thing on the table. And all these other chaps that he thinks he's having a feast of enjoyment with are actually plotting against him. They've got some wine or some sort of drug in it, and they're sneaking this to him. You can see what they want to do. They want to put him to sleep. And then after they've got him to sleep one step, they'll put him to sleep even more permanently in a less sophisticated fashion. On the day of our king, the princes became sick with the heat of wine. He stretched out his hand with mockers. For, like an oven, their hearts burn with intrigue. All night, their anger smoulders. You see the same picture. Their anger smoulders away all night. But then in the morning, it says, it blazes like a flaming fire. Because the time has come, and now they give him the cold steel treatment. And that gets rid of him, and so somebody else then becomes king. All of them, verse 7, all of them are hot as an oven, and they devour their rulers. But all their kings have fallen, and none of them calls upon me. And that's the devastating sentence, that very last one. All their kings have fallen, one after the other, topple, 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 topple. They're all fallen, and nobody, he says, calls after me. They call after Assyria, they call after Egypt, they call after someone else, but they don't call after me. They plot evil against the other king, they become king themselves, somebody plots evil against them, they're assassinated, and so it just goes on, repeating itself over and over again, and they never learn the lesson. And human nature is like that, isn't it? We are remarkably dull sometimes at learning the lesson God is trying to teach us. You find it goes on in verse 8 to tell us that Ephraim mixes himself with the peoples. And when it says Ephraim mixes himself with the peoples, that again is a reference to the alliances which Ephraim makes with the other nations. Israel entering an alliance with Assyria. Israel entering an alliance with Egypt. Mixing himself with the peoples, you see. He is like a cake not turned. You put a cake in the oven, and he's cooking this cake. But the cake is not turned. In other words, it gets burnt on one side, and is not cooked properly on the other side. Now this is what Ephraim is doing. It's relying too much on foreign nations for aid. It's relying not enough on God. Getting burnt to a cinder on one side, and that's not even getting cooked on the other. Trusting in others instead of trusting in God. And so they're like a cake that hasn't been turned over when it's being cooked. That's explained in verse 9. Aliens devour his strength, and he knows it not. He's being weakened all the time by these alliances he makes with other nations. Because if you make an alliance with a nation, sooner or later you're going to fall under the domination of that nation. This was the lesson that Isaiah tried to get through to Ahaz, and then he tried to get it through to Hezekiah. It's the same message that Hosea is trying to get through, that if you make an alliance with a foreign nation, you have in fact invited that nation to interfere in your affairs. Sooner or later you'll fall under the domination of that nation, and eventually the nation will take you over and your own nation will be destroyed. And it happened, of course, as we saw earlier, that Israel eventually lost its independence at the hands of Assyria. And if you go on another century and a half after that, you'll find that Judah in turn lost its independence to Babylon for precisely the same reasons. Aliens devouring their strength, and they didn't even know it. And that, of course, is really tragic, and it can happen always in the lives of God's people. Something there sapping the strength, some parasite eating away the goodness of the life, and the person is unaware of it, wakes up when it's too late. Something devouring his strength, and he knows it not. And so grey hairs are sprinkled upon him, and he knows it not. He's getting towards the end. He's starting to get a bit old, and nearing the end is Israel. And he doesn't realize that he's so close to the end. Verse 10, the pride of Israel witnesses against him. Yet they do not return to the Lord their God, nor seek him for all this. Pride prevents repentance, because the people trust in themselves rather than trust in God. And so in verse 11, Ephraim is like a dove, silly and without sense, calling to Egypt, going to Assyria. Well, if they act like a silly bird, says God, they'll get caught like a silly bird. As they go, verse 12, I will spread over them my net, and I will bring them down like birds of the air. I will chastise them for their wicked deeds. Woe to them, for they have strayed from me. Destruction to them, for they have rebelled against me. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me. I want to save them, but they don't want me. They're deceitful, treacherous, dishonest. Coming down to chapter 8, verse 4, we come to our third section. And again, you have this reference to how they change their kings repeatedly. They made kings, but not through me. They set up princes, but without my knowledge. All these kings who are coming onto the throne and getting moved off very promptly, all of this coming and going was done without consulting God at all. And of course, when God's people create leaders without seeking God's direction, well, they've only got themselves to thank for the problems they land themselves in. They made kings, but not through me. They set up princes, but without my knowledge. With their silver and gold, they made idols to their own destruction. I have spurned your calf, O Samaria. My anger burns against them because you trusted in an idol rather than trusting in God. How long will it be till they are pure in Israel? A workman made it. It is not God. The calf of Samaria shall be broken to pieces. How can a man make a god? Just think of it. How can a man make a god? You can understand a god making a man, but how can a man make a god? And how can a man worship something he makes himself, as we said earlier? A workman made it, but it cannot be God, says the prophet. Well, what's going to happen? Well, I think you can work it out yourself. But just to underline it, the prophet says in verse 7, they sow the wind, they'll reap the whirlwind. The standing grain has no heads, it shall yield no meal. In other words, their Baal worship again will prove fruitless. And if it were to yield, aliens would devour it. Israel is swallowed up. Already they are among the nations as a useless vessel. For they have gone up to Assyria, a wild ass wandering alone. Ephraim has hired lovers. And here again the reference to adultery. In this case, military alliances. Going to Assyria, going to Egypt, hiring lovers, hiring foreign aid. But verse 10 tells us that though they hire allies among the nations, I will soon gather them up, and they shall cease for a little while from anointing kings and princes. In other words, they will go into captivity, and they'll have no Israelite kings at all to be able to govern them any longer. Their foreign policy eventually has led to foreign domination. They have gone to Assyria, they have hired their lovers, and now they're going to get the deserts that they had gone after. They shall cease for a little while from anointing kings and princes means that they'll be taken out of their land and taken into a foreign country. And there in the foreign country they'll be dominated by the overruling power. And of course there'll be no opportunity then for them to have their own rulers. And so they can't anoint kings, they can't anoint princes. All they can do is suffer the affliction that the ruling authority imposes upon them. They lose their independence, they lose their country, they lose everything because of their stupidity in trusting in all sorts of man-made schemes instead of trusting in Jehovah. It goes back to where we were before, doesn't it? They're destroyed for their lack of knowledge. They don't know God, and so they're leading themselves to this sad end. We come then to our final section, and that is in chapter 11. Almost, you might say, this is a pathetic section to read. It reflects on the great love which God had for his people Israel, and how Israel rejected that love and they showed no gratitude to God. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. That is a reference to Israel's bondage in Egypt. Then God called them out of Egypt and liberated them from the oppression of the Egyptians. But note verse 2, the more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baals, burning incense to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took him up in my arms, but they didn't know that I was the one who healed them. I led them with cords of compassion, with bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws. I bent down to them and I fed them. All that God has done for his people, and look at the way they treat him in return. And I'm sure every one of us at times must feel a great sense of shame when we reflect on all that God has done for us, and sometimes the mean way we handle him in return, in the devotion we give to him, in what we offer to him of our time or abilities, or in worship or prayer or cash or whatever it is. The amount that we return to God in gratitude for all that he is to us, sometimes it must cause us, I think, to be rather ashamed of the shabby deal that we've given God in return for all that he has done for us. And here we have Israel again, Ephraim, all that God has done, and how little they have returned. So what's going to happen to them? Well, verse 5 tells us what's going to happen to them. They're going to go back to bondage, back to where they came from, back to slavery. They had been liberated from under the yoke of the Egyptians. They're going to go back to the yoke of the Egyptians and also to the yoke of the Assyrians. They shall return, in verse 5, to the land of Egypt, and also they shall return to the land of Assyria, and Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. The sword shall rage against their cities. It shall consume the bars of their gates. It shall devour them in their fortresses. My people are bent on turning away from me, so they are appointed to the yoke, and none shall remove it. They're determined to go their own way. Okay. They're going to get what they deserve. They're determined not to have me. All right, says God, they won't have me. They'll have a foreign rule over them instead. One of the tragic things at times is that God gives us what we want. Sometimes to punish us, he gives us the things we want. Many times, of course, he doesn't give us the things we want because he may have better in store. But sometimes when he finds his people are so slow to learn and so stubborn, he gives them what they want, and with it sends leanness of soul, as the psalmist says. My people were bent on turning away from me. All right, they can go away from me, and they can serve a foreign yoke instead. Now, do you think God's taking any pleasure in this? None whatever. You read verse 8, and you see something of the anguish that's in the heart of God as he sees what's happening to his people. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? Do you think I like doing this? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? These places that have been destroyed. How can I treat you like that? Do you think I enjoy doing it? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. Hosea has announced God's judgment unequivocally. God's people have departed from him, and God is going to judge them. But within God's judgment, we have this element of mercy. And this is one of the features of the Old Testament. It's a feature of the New Testament too. You get it even in the book of Revelation, and all those dire judgments, so often you find this element of mercy mingled with God's judgment. And here, although he's going to judge his people, he's not going to wipe them out completely. Certainly he's going to take them into a foreign land. Certainly he's going to destroy their city. They're going to be without a king, and they're going to be under foreign domination. But you find there's another element, and that is the element of the restoration, that after God has punished them for a while, he will have mercy and bring them back into his land once again. There is judgment, but yet within that judgment we find there is mercy. And here we can see something of the anguish of the heart of God as he sees what punishment of his people is going to mean to him. Verse 9, I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst. I will not come to destroy. I am God and not man. And that's our confidence, that God is not like men. He's not like men, of course, in many ways, but I think in the context that we're reading about here, God is not like man in two ways. We've seen this in Hosea. This more or less summarizes what we've seen so far. He's not like man, firstly, in that he does not overlook sin. Now, man tends to overlook sin. He tends to gloss over it. He tends to excuse himself. He tends to justify himself. He'd like to pass over the more unpleasant things. God does not overlook sin. God is not like man. But secondly, God is not like man in that he is not revengeful. You fall into the hands of men sometimes and you can get a very bad deal, because people take revenge far in excess of the wrong that was done to them. It's a very fierce and evil thing, this revenge that sometimes grips the hearts of human beings. It wants to get its pound of flesh. It wants to get a tit for tat. It wants to really rub it in as much as it can. But God is not like man. God is not like that. He does have vengeance. He does have justice. But he is not like some spoilt brat of a child, or some person who is nasty and horrible and simply wants to do things for the sake of being nasty. God is just and holy and true. And that can be a person's confidence, because he is not like man. He doesn't go beyond the bounds. He repays, because he is above all one who is holy and just and true. So God says, I am not like man. In other words, even though I'm judging you, even though you've fought against me and you've sent me this anguish of soul, you've thrown me out, so to speak. You haven't returned to me. You've worshipped idols instead of worshipping me. You've done everything that's wrong. Now, you might think that you'd get a complete wiping out, but God says, I am not like man. I am the Holy One in your midst, and I come not to destroy. Certainly I'm going to destroy in the sense that I'm going to get rid of the nation, I'm going to knock down Samaria, I'm going to put you into captivity. But through it all, he says, I'm working eventually to bring you back to myself. I think this is a beautiful picture here. It's the same picture we get when you look at Calvary. You look at the work of Jesus Christ, where you see mercy and truth met together, where you see justice and yet graciousness working hand in glove, God in his justice imposing the penalty that sin deserved, and yet in his mercy offering his forgiveness to those who are repentant. Here you have it again, God instructing his people. And so you read on and you find now that Hosea can look beyond the immediate judgment. He can look to a time when the people will repent and when they will return to God, and then God in his time will bring them back into their land again. He will restore them. He will rebuild the cities, rebuild the nation, and they will become his people again. And so in verse 10, they shall go after the Lord, and he will roar like a lion. When he roars like a lion here, I think it refers to roaring like a lion against their enemies, overpowering their enemies, and delivering the people from the claws of their enemies and bringing them back from captivity into their own land again. Yes, he will roar, and his sons shall come trembling from the west. They shall come trembling like birds from Egypt. They shall come like doves from the land of Assyria, and I will return them to their homes, says the Lord. Yes, I am going to drive them into captivity. But when they've repented, when they've learned the lesson and turned to seek me again, then he says, I'll bring them back and I'll plant them in my land, and through them I will bring my purposes to fulfillment. So much for the problems political. All of the things that we've been looking at, the three areas, the social problems, the religious problems and the political problems, come together in the final study, which we'll be having this evening, when we look at the personal problems of Hosea and the relations between Hosea and his wife and the children that were born to them and what happened. And you'll find that through it all, in spite of the faithlessness of his people, God ever remained faithful, and eventually he would indeed fulfill his purposes. And so you'll find the final story, the personal details concerning Hosea, his wife and family, illustrate the points that we've been seeing up to date.